I feel great and I am full of energy. Check out this review on Beef Organs from Heart and Soil Supplements. I know so many of you are listening to this podcast thinking about how to lose weight, and so I thought this one was particularly appropriate. Eric says, I switched over to a carnivore animal-based diet and needed a supplement to help the proper intake of organs for nutrients since I work a lot and didn't have time to cook them, some of them not super tasty. But I found Heart and Soil and I get everything I need and extra to help on the diet because it's actually real animal products. My energy is amazing. I'm not hungry a lot. My weight keeps getting leaner and this is the healthiest I've felt in a long time. You can find us at heartandsoil.co. All of our products are made from grass-fed, grass-finished animals sourced in New Zealand. Our bottles are glass, never plastic. I believe we make the finest desiccated organ supplements on the planet, and this is a very easy, convenient way to get organs in your diet, no matter what type of diet you're doing. I know that will level up your overall health, your energy, your quality of life, because there are so many unique nutrients in these organs. Find us, heartandsoil.co. Our mission is to help you reclaim your birthright to optimal health. On this week's podcast, I wanted to share a bunch of information about weight loss. I previously posted this one, and it's such an important one. It was very popular. I think that many of you have not heard this, so I wanted to reshare it. There are so many bad ideas out there when it comes to weight loss. There are ways to lose weight, but the question for me is, how do you lose weight sustainably? My concern is that with a lot of dietary strategies, whether this is caloric restriction or carbohydrate restriction and a ketogenic diet, weight loss may happen initially, but I believe that there will be a plateau and there will be collateral, quote, damage with decreased quality of hormones. We know this happens. If you restrict your calories significantly, then your thyroid will sort of turn down your body's basal metabolism. And that in some ways is a race to the bottom. I see this at conferences sometimes where people have lost weight, restricting calories or carbohydrates on ketogenic diets, and they end up in sort of a plateau and they can't go any lower because their thyroid just won't let them go any lower. Their body really can't reduce their basal metabolic rate any further. They can't reduce their calories any further, and they end up in a stuck place. I don't think this is the way to lose weight. As I talk about in this podcast, I think the way to lose weight is to first and foremost focus on your quality of food. And I believe if you do that, for so many of you, the weight will come off effortlessly. The idea is to give your body carbohydrates as you are losing weight so that your body gets the signal of abundance. Fruit and honey, raw milk, those are my favorite things. But however you do it, giving your body of a signal of abundance while you are losing weight, that's often the first step. And that is, I think, the long-term, healthy, sustainable way to do this, rather than driving yourself into a situation where you are in a significant caloric deficit. If your hormones are declining, your testosterone, your thyroid hormones, and your basal metabolic rate in tandem, it's not a good way to lose weight sustainably. So I wanted to reshare this podcast. Hope it is helpful for you guys. As always, if you have questions about how to lose weight, how to construct an animal-based diet, you can reach out to the team at radicalhealth@heartandsoil.co. They'll walk you through this. And I want to give a shout out to my sponsors who make this podcast possible and free every week, starting with Schwenk Grills. I have a Schwenk Grill in Costa Rica. It is one of my favorite things. I brought this Schwenk Grill to Costa Rica because I love it so much. Schwenk is spelled S-C-H-W-A-N-K. It's a 1500 degree grill, meaning that it has this ceramic element and it's a completely stainless steel grill. I cook on this and nothing else really compares. Every time I'm traveling, I always think, well, this grill's okay, but it's not as good as my Schwenk Grill in Costa Rica or when I'm in Austin at the Heart and Soil headquarters. So Schwenk Grills are a revolutionary portable gas infrared grill that heats up to 1500 degrees, delivers premium steakhouse quality taste. They've been using this technology since the 1980s, and now it's available to anyone, but you don't have to just cook steak in it. That's basically what I cook in it, but you can use chicken wings, hamburgers, seafood, vegetables. I don't know why you do that. Pizza with a pizza stone accessory. I'm not going to cook pizza in it, but if you want to, do what you got to do. It's ready in minutes. It's quick. It's ready in as little as 3 minutes, depending on the thickness and the desired doneness. Lobster tails, 5 minutes, salmon, 4 minutes, pizza, less than five. It's pretty incredible. So you can do it anywhere. You can put it in your backyard, tailgating, camping at a friend's house. It's made in the United States as well. So I love my Schwenk Grill. Again, I brought this thing all the way to Costa Rica. I always cook on it there. If you guys have seen my videos on Instagram or social media, you'll see me cooking on the Schwenk Grill and grilling stuff up, and it always looks amazing. So you can get $150 off a Schwenk 1500 degree grill at schwenkgrills.com. That's S-C-H-W-A-N-K-grills.com when using the promo code Paul150 at checkout. So it's schwenkgrills.com. Promo code is Paul150, Paul150. I also want to give a shout out to my friends at Earth Runners. You can find them at earthrunners.com. The code is carnivore for 10% off. Now, I am going to have Clint Ober on the podcast next week to talk about grounding. I've been thinking a lot about grounding recently. Obviously, in Costa Rica, I'm in the ocean, I'm barefoot, but when I'm traveling, I think about it even more. And I think that the benefits of grounding have not been talked about enough for humans. And this idea that evolutionarily, historically, we were always or almost always touching the earth most of the time when we were sleeping, certainly when we were walking around, when we were hunting, when we were climbing trees or climbing rocks, we were touching the earth. There's interesting science behind this negative charge that we get from the earth and how that affects our immune system. It sounds crazy, but when you look at the science, it's impressive and it makes so much sense evolutionarily. But then come the rubber-soled shoes and they prevent us from being grounded. Many of us, myself included, if we don't think about this, are never grounded at all in the entire day, not when we sleep, not when we're walking around, which is why earth runners are so cool. They have a copper earthing plug and conductive laces that keep you grounded to the earth when you're walking in sandals. So if you're out on a hike, you are touching the earth. You don't have to have your bare foot on the earth because that can hurt your foot, but you can get this millennia old footwear design known as the Huarache sandal upgraded with a wrapping lace and this copper earthing plug and conductive laces. They have a Vibram sole and they give you the most minimalist, natural, and grounded shoe experience you've ever had. It helps you restore your natural connection to the earth. And there are so many benefits of that, as you'll hear on next week's podcast, but it's truly evolutionarily consistent and supported by science. So you can find them at earthrunners.com. Use the code carnivore for 10% off checkout. And no matter how you do it, put something like earthrunners on your foot, walk around barefoot, but think about grounding and see how it improves your life. That's earthrunners.com. The code is carnivore. I also want to give a shout out to my friends at Kalima Sea Salt. Every year, humans dump 8 million tons of plastic garbage in the ocean, which is crazy because that's where your table salt comes from. The garbage breaks down into tiny pieces called microplastics, and salt from the ocean crystallizes around these microplastics. That's the core of most salt crystals. That means when you sprinkle it on your steak, veggies, or French fries, careful with those French fries if they're cooked in seed oil, don't do that. You are literally eating tiny pieces of plastic bags, water bottles, or other garbage. A new study reveals microplastics are in 90% of all salt tested, but there are no ocean-borne microplastics in Kalima sea salt. They are free of ocean-borne microplastics. You get your first bag free at drpaulsalt.com. It's freaking delicious, super crunchy. It's a great finishing salt. It's harvested from the Kalima salt flats in Mexico. So you're supporting the salineros there, 100% all natural, unrefined, handmade, hand-harvested sea salt. Again, drpaulsalt.com for your free bag of Kalima sea salt. I want to give a shout out to my friends at BonCharge, BonCharge.com. As I am recording this, my computer is on a EMF blocking mat. When I travel on airplanes, I use an EMF blocking mat between my computer and me on the plane. When I put this laptop on my lap, I am using an EMF blocking mat because there is a significant amount of EMF, electromagnetic radiation, coming from this computer or your wireless Bluetooth headphones and into your body. And I don't want that Bluetooth radiation going into my brain or my junk. So you should check out BonCharge because they have amazing solutions for this. They sell this EMF blocking mat for your computer, making your laptop actually usable on your lap, on the couch, wherever you want to be, in your bed, on a plane. It's going to make your laptop much safer. And they sell EMF reducing, significantly reducing headphones, earbuds that are going to be much, much lower EMF than your wireless AirPods. So think about the EMF that's going into your junk, into your head, and check out BonCharge at BonCharge.com. You can use the code CarnivoreMD to save 15% off. While you're there, you can also get blue light blocking glasses, which are great because, as we know, blue light is not good for humans at all. So really appreciate them. And that is it. On to the podcast, my friends. I believe that all discussions of how to lose weight probably start with how not to lose weight. Let's just start the whole conversation around how to lose weight with the understanding that the point of losing weight is to become healthier. For some people, the point of losing weight is to look a certain way, and they may not prioritize overall health and hormonal robustness and health. I'm thinking of bodybuilders here, and that's their legitimate endeavor. If they want to do certain things, calorie restrict, macronutrient adjust to get down to very low levels of body fat. And they obviously have lots of muscle because they're bodybuilding. To look a certain way, that is fine. But that is not a healthy phenotype. That is not a healthy state for a human. It is obvious and clear to anyone who's looked at the hormones
and the overall health of people who are doing those bodybuilding shows, that is not a healthy condition for a human. So let's assume for the purposes of this podcast that our discussion is about how to lose weight healthfully and how to lose weight with the intention of being healthier. I think that all conversations of how to lose weight should start with how to become a healthier individual, and following beyond that will be weight loss. I believe that if you become healthier, you will lose weight, so that you should focus on being healthier. And I will outline what I think that means from a dietary and lifestyle and exercise perspective in this podcast. But I do not think the goal of any endeavor for humans should be to lose weight. Nevertheless, if that is your goal, focus on becoming healthy. Again, I will outline that in this podcast. How to not lose weight is to become less healthy while you are losing weight. I think if more people checked morning testosterone, cortisol, looked at those ratios, looked at TSH, thyroid stimulating hormone, T4 and T3, perhaps reverse T3 levels during their weight loss efforts, it would give them a feedback. It would give them some sort of a triangulation that would tell them if they are doing it in a healthful way. All of these things are going to change as the body loses weight, but I think if there are massive changes in hormonal function, especially thyroid function, to slow the thyroid and have a negative effect on the thyroid, then what you are doing to lose weight is probably not sustainable long-term, and it's probably not good for your overall health. Similarly, if you are losing weight and your testosterone crashes because you are fasting or you are consistently calorie restricting, and I will talk about calories in versus calories out in a moment, without attention to dietary quality, then I think that you are moving toward an unhealthy state of weight loss, an unhealthy state of being a human, and you should consider that in your weight loss journey. I do believe there are healthy ways for humans to lose weight. These often center on focusing on dietary quality. And I believe if you do that, rather than focusing on restricting calories without attention to dietary quality, you will lose weight unintentionally, as has been demonstrated in the past with diets that include meat and fruit, specifically paleo diets, which have vegetables, but we'll talk about those a bit later on in the podcast. If you focus on dietary quality, I believe you will lose weight without having to work at it too hard. And that is the best way to lose weight. How not to lose weight? Don't put yourself in a calorie restricted prison. The human body, our metabolism, our brain, the hypothalamus, all of the mechanisms of the body that control satiety, from the stomach to the duodenum, the ghrelin system, our neuroendocrine hormones, our gastrointestinal hormones that feed back to the brain, are exquisitely evolved over millions of years of pre-hominid evolution and hundreds of thousands of years of Homo sapiens evolution to prevent us from starving. If we've gotten to be obese, and I will talk about why I think that happens, we've gone off of our evolutionary programming in some way. We've probably eaten a diet that is evolutionarily inconsistent. I believe that is what drives us to get fat. Doing evolutionarily inconsistent things in our consumption of specific foods, specific macronutrients. I'll talk about those later. And that leads to an evolutionarily disordered state of obesity. You don't see a lot of obesity. In fact, you don't see any obesity when you go to hunter-gatherer tribes like the Hadza, who I visited last year. I'll show some studies with them later in the podcast. Or if you go to look at the Yukung or other hunter-gatherers, there's no obesity there. In fact, when I went to visit the Hadza, there was one woman in the tribe who was overweight. She was actually the wife of the chief of the tribe. And we asked the chief, or we asked the tribe, what happened to her in a polite way. And the response we got was that she had been spending more time with missionaries in the city and eating things like cornmeal, processed food, processed grains, and seed oils. So this is an of one. It's an interesting anecdote, but it does illustrate that even hunter-gatherers can get fat if they eat a westernized type diet. We see this over and over when humans of all sorts of nationalities, all sorts of cultures, move from more evolutionarily consistent foods, which can be a wide variety of things, and they go onto a westernized diet pattern, which is an amorphous term, but I will clarify it in a moment. They often become obese and they become metabolically unwell, metabolically unhealthy, metabolically disordered. Those are all synonyms, insulin resistant. So what is a westernized diet pattern? No one really agrees on this, but it is a diet consisting of processed foods, very clearly, usually refined grains, usually seed oils, and usually processed sugars. It's not rocket science. It's pretty clear that when humans eat this way, we get fat. But it's interesting to me to break down and distill what part of that westernized diet is the most harmful part. Some people would point to the meat on a westernized diet and say, look, a low fiber, meat heavy diet is what makes us fat. I don't think that's the problem because there are a lot of people who do low fiber, meat heavy diets who lose a lot of weight. I believe that it's much more likely that other elements of our westernized dietary pattern, refined carbohydrates, refined grains, refined sugars, and seed oils are the major drivers of obesity. So if you want the Cliff Notes version of this podcast, how do you get unfat? You undo the westernized dietary pattern you've gotten yourself into by avoiding all of those things. We will talk about all of them in this podcast. I think that questions of why you would want to lose weight are almost self-evident, but consider studies like this as an example of the fact that obesity is associated with inflammation. And many studies from this review show that losing weight, at least 10% of the body mass, reduces obesity-related inflammatory markers, ORIM, in this study, including C-reactive protein, TNF-alpha, IL-6, and leptin. So, of course, losing weight is a good thing for humans. No, nothing surprising here. But how effective are we overall at losing weight as humans? Not so good, because most of the dietary strategies that we employ are not focused on improving the quality of the food, nor are they necessarily focused on reversing the pattern of a westernized diet. They're more focused on simply reducing the westernized diet and eating less of a bunch of bad foods. I'm thinking of things like Weight Watchers or other calorie-restricted patterns. That's exactly the same problem that got you into this mess and got you obese. You're just eating less of it. There's a much easier way, a much better way long-term to lose weight, and it's improving the quality of your diet. So this is an interesting study looking at the probability of an obese person attaining normal body weight. This is a cohort study using electronic records. They say that the probability of attaining normal weight or maintaining weight loss is low. No shit, Sherlock. So in this study, there was a maximum follow-up of 9 years. There were 1,200 men and 2,200 women who attained a normal body weight. They said that the annual probability of attaining normal weight was 1 in 210 for men and 1 in 124 for women, increasing to 1 in 1,290 for men and 1 in 677 for women with morbid obesity. The annual probability of achieving a 5% weight reduction was 1 in 8 for men and 1 in 7 for women with morbid obesity. Why is it so hard for us to lose weight well? I've already talked about it, because most of the dietary strategies out there are calorie prisons. You wouldn't want to go to a state penitentiary. Prison is no fun. Well, restricting your calories is essentially calorie prison. It's horrible. Eventually, you are going to want to do everything you can to dig out of there, to break out of there. This is Shawshank Redemption for your freaking metabolism, for your brain. You have 350,000 years of human evolution that are telling you to break out of a prison that you are putting yourself in by restricting calories. There's an easier way, and it's focusing on food quality. Now, at the beginning of this podcast, I also want to address the calories in, calories out model. This is essentially thermodynamics. Yes, it works. If you eat more calories, then you metabolize, then you oxidize, then you burn, you will gain weight. The problem with this equation is that it's very hard to know what your calories out are. It's not as simple as simply using a program on the internet to calculate your basal metabolic rate and then doing some back of the envelope calculations based on how active you are. If you are overexercising, for instance, you may increase your cortisol, you may lower your thyroid hormone, you may increase your reverse T3. All of those things will slow your overall metabolism, which will lead to a lower calories out. I also think there's very interesting evidence that the quality of the foods you eat, the quality of your calories in, can negatively or positively affect your calories out. I'll show evidence later in this podcast that seed oils, polyunsaturated fatty acids of the omega-6 variety, can affect thyroid hormone, transport, metabolism, and binding at the level of the nuclear T3 receptor in a negative way. So the quality of the foods you eat can affect your metabolism on the way out. That's the problem with the calories in, calories out model, in my opinion. It's too simplified. You can't simply eat Pop-Tarts and expect to be healthy long-term or expect to achieve weight loss long-term because your overall health will suffer. You may lose weight originally, but I can guarantee you that your hormones will tank and your metabolism will suffer, your motivation will suffer, you will become nutrient depleted, and you will not retain that weight loss long-term. That's not health. That's not a good way to lose weight. That is how you don't want to lose weight. If you don't change the quality of your foods, I fear that your weight loss will not be sustainable and that you will lose health as you are trying to lose weight, which essentially negates the whole point of the endeavor. The other thing to mention is that overexercising is probably not great for weight loss. Look at the success of people on The Biggest Loser in keeping their weight off long-term. It's abysmal. These people overexercise like crazy. And for many of the same reasons that I've talked about, their hormones tank, they have negative effects on all sorts of metrics of their overall health, overall vitality, and they can't keep themselves in a healthy state. They never really were in a healthy state. They've put themselves in calorie-restricted prison. By God, they're going to break out. This is similar to the work of Herman Ponser, who wrote the book Burn. I had him on my podcast a couple of years ago, and we talked about his hypothesis that for a lot of humans, like the Hadza, who he studied and looked at their cardiovascular health, which was very good, their basal metabolic rate changes based on the amount of exercise they're doing. This means that overexercising and spending hours and hours doing cardio thinking you're going to burn off the donut doesn't really work. Sometimes if you work out a bunch, you're going to decrease your overall metabolism and you won't end up burning more calories than someone who is doing light exercise or much less exercise than you are doing. What we do know pretty clearly is that having more lean muscle mass on your body will elevate your lean body mass. So as I've talked about in the past, I am not a fan of chronic cardio, as Mark Sisson would say. Running a whole bunch makes you a smaller version of yourself. It doesn't make you more muscular. It makes you a smaller version of what you are now. If you are a little pudgy, running is probably going to make you a little pudgy, smaller version of yourself. It's not going to give you the effects you want long-term. How do you lose weight? A key cornerstone of this is having lean body mass, something that probably includes lifting heavy things and having a good androgen receptor density, something that both men and women can benefit from. If you listened to last week's podcast, you'll know that soy, isoflavonoids in soy like genistein can negatively affect androgen receptor density in men. So again, the quality of the foods you eat, the biochemical, the neurohormonal, the hormonal effects of the foods you eat will influence your basal metabolism, will influence your ability to burn calories, and that is how you lose weight. Ultimately, I think you want your basal metabolic rate to be as high as possible, and you don't want to overexercise. More on that later. But calories in, calories out, of course it works. That's thermodynamics. It's highly oversimplified, and it's not as simple as just restricting the food you eat. That doesn't work long-term. Let's return to the question of why we get fat. The most basic answer to this question is that we get fat because we're eating too much. Rates of obesity, rates of being overweight, which are different body mass index thresholds, are skyrocketing in this country, over 40 and 70% respectively, if you consider overweight and obese together. Today, we are an extremely fat nation. So why is this happening? Well, we're eating too much. We're eating more. These are graphics from Jeff Knobs. I've used them in my cookbook, and I appreciate him letting me use them. So if you look since 1960, our total food intake has increased moderately. You can see in 1960, perhaps 2,700 calories a day. In 2017 about, which is where this graphic ends, it's close to 3,500 calories a day. Maybe 3,400, 3,300 calories a day. There's about a 500 calorie increase in the last 50 to 60 years in our overall food. But what foods are we eating more of? Well, look at this graphic. This goes from 1960 to 2017 as well. These are trends in daily calories from major food groups. You can see meat. Well, yeah, we're eating a little bit more meat, but it's gone down since the late 90s. We're eating a little bit more sugars and sweeteners since the 1960s. There's a slight increase in this light green line, which indicates root vegetables. But the single greatest increase in calories since 1960 is in vegetable oils. Again, this is just an association. This is a correlation, but it's quite interesting to note. Our overall consumption of dairy has gone down slightly since 1960. So it's probably not milk or cheese that's making us fat. But what about this line? What about this vegetable oil line that is going straight up? We had 276 calories per day in 1960 from seed oils, 699 calories per day from seed oils in 2017. I wonder what it is now in 2022. And the last graphic that I want to show is trends in plant versus animal food consumption. Again, this graphic also goes from 1960 to 2017. Animal foods have stayed approximately the same, and plant foods have gone up significantly. This is probably also indicating that vegetable oils are considered a plant food, as they are. But if you break down this animal foods graphic, you'll see that it's not more red meat that we're eating now, it's more chicken. In fact, red meat consumption has gone down in the last 30 to 40 years, but we're eating more chicken today. That's what accounts for the increase in meat. So where are these excess calories coming from? Why are we eating more? This is my hypothesis, that we are more hungry because of this westernized dietary pattern. I don't believe that it's because we have more access to food or because we are lazier. In fact, Americans continue to exercise and do healthy behaviors. I believe that it is an increased proportion of our dietary calories that are coming from foods, particularly highly processed foods like seed oils, processed sugars, and processed grains that can hijack our satiety mechanisms. And I will show you lots of evidence for that. And that is why we are eating more, because Shawshank calorie prison sucks. But you know what also sucks? Shawshank hunger prison. Being hungry and not eating leads to being hangry. You tell me the last time you were hungry and you had food in front of you and you didn't eat it. So a lot of people in this audience might actually have times when they've done that, when they've been fasting or doing intermittent fasting or choosing to skip a meal. But for the majority of our population as Americans, as US citizens, as Westerners, if you are hungry, you go and eat. So we're fatter, but we're also hungrier. Why are we hungrier? I believe it's because of this westernized dietary pattern that is making us more hungry. How do we reverse that? How do we lose weight properly? We become less hungry. We look for more satiety. That is how you lose weight. If you are hungry, you may lose weight in the short term, but I do not believe your weight loss will be sustainable in the long term. If you are not hungry, I think you might just have a chance of getting back into that bikini, into that Speedo, or getting out of the beach with a six-pack. The other piece of the satiety equation is, of course, nutrients. I believe that if humans are not taking in an adequate array of micronutrients, that they will continue to be hungry. So, two sides of the satiety coin. Things that are hijacking our satiety: seed oils, processed sugars, processed grains, probably. Certainly seed oils, based on the literature. Nutrient inadequacy, both micro and perhaps macronutrient inadequacy. So micronutrients, what am I talking about? Minerals, vitamins, folate, choline, riboflavin, carnitine, anserine, K2, B12, biotin, all of these micronutrients, zinc, magnesium, copper, manganese, selenium. Is it possible that you will continue to eat if you are needing one of those micronutrients? I believe it is. And then macronutrients as well. There are many people who believe in something called the protein leverage hypothesis. I think that's a reasonable hypothesis that if we don't get an adequate amount of protein in our diet every day, we will remain hungry. I think that the major drivers of obesity are inadequate micronutrient intake and the satiety sabotaging effects of the processed food components, seed oils, processed grains, processed sugars. I think there are fewer people who are not getting enough protein, and that is what is causing them to overeat. So how do seed oils cause us to be more hungry? How do seed oils sabotage our satiety? Studies like this one done in an animal model give us some real clues. I spoke about this in more detail in a previous podcast with Tucker Goodrich. The title of this study is Dietary Linoleic Acid Elevates Endogenous 2-AG and Anandamide and Induces Obesity. Again, this is an animal model, but they fed mice different amounts of linoleic acid in their diets. And what they found was that increasing linoleic acid from 1% to 8% elevated arachidonic acid phospholipids in the liver and erythrocytes, tripled 2-AG and 1-AG and AEA, which is anandamide, associated with increased food intake, feed efficiency, and adiposity in mice. So what are 2-AG and anandamide? They are essentially cannabinoids. These are similar to the compounds found in marijuana, cannabidiol, THC, cannabidiverin. These are endogenous cannabinoids. We have them in our body because we need these neurotransmitters in our brains. We have receptors for cannabinoids in our brains, the CB1 and CB2 receptors. But in this animal study, when they were given increasing amounts of linoleic acid in the diet, they saw increasing amounts of cannabinoids, 2-AG, 1-AG, and AEA, which is anandamide, which led to increased feed efficiency, meaning that mice were incorporating more calories into their bodies. Essentially, basal metabolic rate appeared to be lowering, which is something that I'll talk about in a moment with regard to thyroid hormones in connection with linoleic acid, and they had adiposity. How fascinating is that? On the flip side, there are very interesting studies in mice showing that if you feed mice stearic acid, an 18-carbon saturated fatty acid found in animal fats, things like milk, cheese, butter, and tallow, that those mice get lean. They lose weight, they lose visceral adiposity, and they become healthy. This is one of the reasons that I'm a fan of saturated fats in animals, but I wanted to juxtapose that with an 18-carbon omega-6 polyunsaturated fat linoleic acid feeding in mice makes them fat, probably because of these cannabinoids. The story becomes more interesting when you think about a drug called rimonabant. Rimonabant was a drug approved in the early 2000s for use as an anti-obesity, as a weight loss drug. Rimonabant is a CB1, a cannabinoid 1 inverse agonist, meaning that it blocks the cannabinoid 1 receptor by activating it incorrectly. So what you have with rimonabant is something that is the opposite of 2-AG and anandamide, and it did lead to satiety, less feelings of hunger, and weight loss, as you can see in these trials. This is a 2006 trial from Circulation. Title is Cannabinoid 1 Receptor Antagonist Rimonabant for Management of Obesity and Related Risks. In Table 1 in this trial, you can see mean placebo subtracted 1-year weight loss for rimonabant versus currently approved anti-obesity drugs. Rio Europe, Rio Lipids, Rio North America, and Rio Diabetes were all trials including rimonabant, and the average weight loss was 4.7 to 5.4 kilograms over the course of months to years, with some of the longer trials being 2-year treatments with rimonabant in the Rio North America study. So not a huge weight loss, but giving a drug and doing nothing else resulted in 10 pounds of weight loss for people, which could be powerful for some people, just by affecting the CB1 receptor. The problem came later when rimonabant for the prevention of cardiovascular events, this is the Crescendo trial, was published in 2010. And if you look at this trial, you will see they said that at a mean follow-up of 13.8 months, the trial was prematurely discontinued because of concerns by health regulatory authorities in three countries about suicide in individuals receiving rimonabant. As I've spoken about a lot recently, I do have concerns about pharmaceutical industries hiding this type of data. So it's good to see that this data came out, that rimonabant was pulled. It turns out that humans do need some neurotransmitter signaling at our CB1 receptor, or we get a little depressed, and it looked like suicide was a problem with this drug. The mechanism of the drug is what interests me, though, this anti-obesity effect that comes with an antagonism or inverse agonism at the level of the CB1 receptor in the brain. And we know that eating more seed oils, at least in mice, tickles that receptor more because endogenous cannabinoids, or I should say, because cannabinoids 2-AG and anandamide appear to be overproduced. What other evidence do we have regarding omega-6 fatty acids and obesity? There's a number of other interesting studies to consider. So this one is titled The Crucial Role of Dietary Omega-6 Polyunsaturated Fats in Excess Adipose Tissue Development, a Relationship to Childhood Obesity. There's an interesting chart here where they hypothesize mechanisms by which all of this happens. But the takeaway is essentially that downstream products of omega-6 fatty acid metabolism, and we're focusing mostly on linoleic acid here, may affect the differentiation of fat cells when children are growing, leading to greater adiposity later in life. There's a number that suggests this. Another trial, an emerging risk factor for obesity, does disequilibrium of polyunsaturated fatty acid metabolism contribute to excess adipose tissue development? In the abstract, they say adipose tissue development, i.e. both size of the adipocytes, which is called hypertrophy, and number, hyperplasia, is stimulated by high dietary fat intake during early postnatal development, a susceptibility that now appears to continue well into adulthood. The authors go on to state, recent human and animal studies suggest that by altering rates of adipocyte differentiation and proliferation, differences in the composition of dietary fat may also contribute to adipose tissue development. In rodent models, the relative intake of N6 to N3, omega-6 to omega-3, is clearly emerging as a new factor in this development. In these models, linoleic acid intake raises tissue arachidonic acid, which increases prostacyclin production and in turn stimulates signaling pathways implicated in adipogenesis. Giving linoleic acid to rats makes more fat cells, especially in postnatal development. Could this be happening in humans as well? I'm worried about it, especially when you think about how many polyunsaturated fats many mothers are eating and how much of that polyunsaturated omega-6 fatty acid gets into their breast milk. And we know that when women increase their consumption of omega-6 fatty acids, that goes into breast milk. Here's another interesting study. Maternal plasma polyunsaturated fatty acid status in late pregnancy is associated with offspring body composition in childhood. What they found was that after adjustment for maternal factors and child factors, including height and duration of breastfeeding, the maternal plasma levels of omega-6 polyunsaturated fatty acid concentration positively predicted fat mass at 4 years. The p-value was 0.01 and at 6 years with a p-value of 0.04, meaning that the more polyunsaturated fats mom was eating and she had in her blood and that were in her breast milk being passed through the placenta to the baby or through the breast milk to the baby, the fatter the kid was at 4 and 6 years. That's not good. And it begs the question of whether excess polyunsaturated fatty acid consumption by mom during pregnancy or during breastfeeding, during early childhood development, can lead to more adiposity in kids. It's a scary, scary thought. But what are our kids eating? Foods that are soaked in polyunsaturated seed oils. And what are moms eating? Unfortunately, a lot of moms are eating foods that are also soaked in polyunsaturated fatty acids. You don't have to go very far down the aisles in the grocery store to find kids' foods, cookies, cakes, crackers, or other processed foods that both mom and kids will be eating that are high in polyunsaturated fatty acids. And what are we being told to eat based on our dietary guidelines? If you follow me on Instagram, you know that I've done some reels about the 2020 to 2025 nutritional guidelines. From the United States government, we are being recommended to avoid animal fats like stearic acid and to consume polyunsaturated fatty acids. Is it any wonder that our kids, that we, that our brothers and sisters and moms and dads are getting really fat? It's really compelling and it's very interesting to consider this, and it gives us a clear way forward in the changes we might make in our diet. If you have any questions about the amount of polyunsaturated fatty acids we're eating, it's massively increased. Since the 1950s, the amount of linoleic acid that we're consuming as a westernized culture in the United States is 100% greater than it was 50 to 70 years ago. We have doubled, I would say even 1.5 to 2x our consumption of linoleic acid, and that is significantly increased from what it was in 1910. If you look at hunter-gatherer cultures like the Hadza, the Akung, or humans living in the wild, their consumption is 2% of their calories from linoleic acid. Our consumption of linoleic acid is often 15%+ of our calories. Remember the graphic I showed earlier in this podcast showing that just since 1960, our daily calories of vegetable oils have gone from 280 689, give or take, to 699 calories a day. And these are not just excess calories. These are excess calories that affect calories out. These are excess calories that can affect signaling pathways in the differentiation of fat cells that can make you hungrier at the level of your brain and your cannabinoid receptors, and that can affect your thyroid hormones in a negative way, also decreasing your basal metabolic rate. That's how calories in affect calories out. All fat has 9 calories per gram, right? Yes, and not all fat is created equally in the way it will affect your satiety, your hunger, your basal metabolism, and how fat or lean you are. If you are interested in effects of polyunsaturated fatty acids on thyroid, you can consider papers like this, a 1988 paper in Metabolism. Title is Inhibition of Nuclear T3 Binding by Fatty Acids. This is done in vitro with rat liver nuclei, but linoleic acid significantly inhibited the ability of T3, triiodothyronine, the active form of thyroid hormone, to bind to its nuclear receptor in these nuclei, suggesting a mechanism by which linoleic acid in your cells, which we know linoleic acid gets into your cells, in your nuclear membranes, could negatively impact the ability of your thyroid hormone to actually work. And this paper, The Effect of Long-Chain Fatty Acids on the Binding of Thyroxine, which is T4, and triiodothyronine, which is T3, to human thyroxine binding globulin. Yes, your thyroid hormones are carried on a binding globulin. What the researchers found, and I'll quote the abstract, the results indicate that the unsaturated long-chain fatty acids, linoleic acid, are potent inhibitors of thyroxine binding to thyroxine binding globulin, whereas saturated fatty acids have little or no effect on thyroid binding. Have we really done enough research in the medical sphere looking at the way these polyunsaturated fatty acids might negatively be affecting our thyroid hormones? I don't think so. And as I've talked about publicly in the past, I think it's no secret this is because most studies are paid for by pharmaceutical companies. Who will pay for a study that makes seed oils look bad? Who will pay for a study looking at seed oils in regard to thyroid hormones? Who stands to benefit? I'm not sure. I don't know if that study will ever be done, which is why nutritional science moves slowly and is very difficult to do. This is one of the reasons that I built the Animal-Based Nutrition Research Foundation. You can find it at abnrf.org. We are currently raising money for a study that we are doing with Stefan Van Vliet at Utah State University, comparing an animal-based diet to a plant-based diet to an AHA or ADA diet for autoimmune conditions. So you can find it at abnrf.org. But that is something we hope to do in the future and move the needle in a positive way. We're also going to be doing a couple of other studies if we have enough funding in the future, looking at some linoleic acid data. But exciting things on the horizon there. I'm trying to positively affect the research landscape, or at least contribute to the research landscape in as unbiased a way as I can. We all have our bias, you know that, but I would like to see diets that are low in seed oils, like an animal-based diet, compared to diets that have moderate or even recommended amounts of seed oils in them, like an AHA diet. The American Heart Association recommends seed oils. I don't understand it. So that's a discussion of seed oils. I don't think we really understand the mechanisms by which processed grains, processed sugars may be hijacking our metabolism, but they certainly appear to be problematic for humans in many ways. Let's talk for a moment about nutrient adequacy and satiety. This is harder to study, but there is interesting research looking at unique nutrients in animal foods, and this is something I've talked about an awful lot, that are probably very important for human satiety. The title of this paper is Novel Aspects of Health-Promoting Compounds in Meat. I think it's a fascinating one. The authors say meat provides often overlooked components of importance for human health. These are amino acids and bioactive compounds that may be very important in preventing muscle wasting diseases such as sarcopenia, reducing food and caloric intake to prevent metabolic syndrome, blood pressure homeostasis via ACE inhibitory components from connective tissue, and maintaining a functional gut environment through meat-derived nucleotides and nucleosides. In addition, meat could be an important source of phytanic acid, which is a branched-chain fatty acid that appears to be critical for human health and is only found in animal foods. The last sentence of this abstract has me pretty skeptical. They say, further, it becomes increasingly apparent that the design of an in vitro meat will be possible. This is not a good way to go. And this development may lead to improved health benefits from commercially viable and sustainable meat products. You guys know how I feel about that. There's a very sustainable way to make meat. It is by regenerative agriculture. So disregard the last sentence of this abstract, which has me a little bit dubious of these authors in general, but they do make important points about the nutrients in meat, reducing food intake, creating satiety, being beneficial for blood pressure, homeostasis, connective tissue. I love that they talk about a gut environment through meat-derived nucleotides and nucleosides, which is something that very few people talk about, the importance of meat for a healthy gut microbiome. So these are all critical components of what makes meat and organs a big part of satiety for humans. So just earlier today, I was filming a reel for Instagram and I had all of the organs laid out. I had heart, I had liver, I had spleen, and I had kidney, and I had bone marrow. And I was talking about the nutrients in all of those organs. It's important to realize that when I say meat, I mean meat and organs. Our ancestors thought of meat as meat and organs, not just muscle meat. Muscle meat is one type of meat, but there's also liver, heart, spleen, kidney, pancreas. Our ancestors would never have wasted these organs, which is why I am such a big fan of getting organs into your diet. It's hard for a lot of people to get organs in your diet, which is why I built Heart and Soil. If you need more organs in your diet, I believe getting more organs, either fresh or desiccated in your diet, will significantly improve your overall quality of life. You can check us out at heartandsoil.co. That's .co. Along the same lines of meat is dairy. And this is a very interesting aside that I'll just touch on for a few minutes. Here's a review article from Food and Nutrition Research. The title of the article is Milk and Dairy Products, Good or Bad for Human Health? An Assessment of the Totality of the Scientific Evidence. This was published in 2016. They say the most recent evidence suggests that intake of milk and dairy products was associated with reduced risk of childhood obesity. That's interesting. Are the fats in milk perhaps crowding out the seed oils? There are interesting, important fats in milk, things like stearic acid, odd chain fatty acids, which I'll mention in a moment. They go on to say an adult's intake of dairy products was shown to improve body composition, facilitate weight loss during energy restrictions. That's an energy-restricted weight loss trial. Intake of milk and dairy products was associated with neutral or reduced risk of type 2 diabetes and a reduced risk of cardiovascular disease, particularly stroke. Among cancers, milk and dairy intake was inversely associated with colorectal cancer, bladder cancer, gastric cancer, breast cancer, and was not associated with risk of pancreatic, ovarian cancer, or lung cancer, while the evidence for prostate cancer risk was inconsistent. Finally, consumption with milk and dairy products was not associated with all-cause mortality. So the authors of this assessment of much of the scientific evidence suggest that dairy is beneficial for humans. Before I move on to talk about raw versus pasteurized milk, I do want to talk about odd-chain fatty acids. These are yet another component of animal foods, specifically animal fats like dairy, that are associated with human health that are not found in plant foods. No one ever talks about odd chain fatty acids because we don't hear about it in nutrition. There are all of these nutritional components, many of which are predominantly found or exclusively found in animal foods that appear to promote satiety, that associate. We can't draw causative inference, but there's a strong, consistent association between these nutrients and improved health in humans. Odd chain fatty acids, pentadecanoic acid, hexadecanoic acid are just some of those. They say pairing our findings with evidence that C15, which is pentadecanoic acid, is not readily made endogenously in the human body. Lower C15 dietary intake and blood concentrations are associated with higher mortality and poorer physiologic state. And 3, C15 has demonstrated activities and efficacy that parallel associated human benefits in humans. We propose C15 as a potential essential fatty acid, an essential fatty acid found almost exclusively in animal foods. Imagine that. Sorry, vegans. Further studies are needed to evaluate the potential impact of decades of reduced odd-chain fatty acid-containing foods as contributors to C15 deficiencies as susceptibilities to chronic disease. Yes, that's right. Almost all of the foods that are high in C15 and C17 are vilified, and you are told to not eat them. Maybe we made a mistake in mainstream nutrition. Imagine that. So let's talk briefly about raw versus pasteurized dairy. There are a couple of really interesting cohort studies. The Parzival study and the Gabriella study that correlate strongly consumption of farm milk, which is raw milk, with lower rates of asthma and allergy across populations in Europe, both suburban and rural populations. The authors of both of these studies were careful to control for farm exposure, which didn't change the results. Even kids in suburban areas who don't live on farms, who consume raw milk in childhood, had lower rates of asthma, eczema, and allergic illness. Something I wish I had had exposure to when I was a kid, because those things plagued me throughout my life. So this is the first one, inverse association of farm milk consumption with asthma and allergies in rural and suburban populations across Europe. The conclusions, our results indicate that consumption of farm milk may offer protection against asthma and allergy. They go on, and there's another study. Similar results were obtained in the Gabriella study. The protective effect of farm milk consumption on childhood asthma and atopy, which is allergic illness, the Gabriella study. Now, interestingly, they say the mechanism of action is not clear, and boiled farm milk did not show a protective effect. They also show that total viable bacterial counts and total fat content of the milk were not significantly related to asthma or atopy, which is allergic illness. So the original hypothesis regarding the results of these studies, which were that consuming farm milk, raw milk, decreased asthma, decreased eczema, decreased allergy, these are all atopic conditions. The original hypothesis was that this may be related to beneficial bacteria in the milk, but there was no connection or association between the bacterial counts. They did hypothesize that perhaps it was related to the whey protein fraction of the milk that may be changed with pasteurization. I actually think this is even more compelling and interesting a possibility. And there was a follow-up paper. The loss of the allergy protective capacity of raw cow's milk after heat treatment coincides with loss of immunologically active whey proteins. So you can see here that when the milk was heated above 65 degrees centigrade, they lost the allergic protection, and that was when the immune-related functionality started to denature. So when the milk was heated above 65 degrees, they lost the allergy protection, and the native whey proteins and as well as extensive protein aggregation was observed at 75 to 65 degrees centigrade. So it's quite possible that heating milk may change the whey protein, and this may make milk immunologically triggering for some people if it's been pasteurized. And it suggests that an undenatured, raw, unheated, or heated to less than 65 degrees centigrade milk could be immunologically beneficial because of the undenatured whey proteins. How fascinating is that? I certainly appeared to have problems with pasteurized milk growing up, but if I'd had access to raw milk, would my eczema, would my asthma have been different? And I've heard many people talk about the removal of milk being a beneficial thing in their lives. But I wonder if raw milk would be better for them. There are those who don't tolerate the lactose in milk. I'm one of these people. If that's you, use kefir or yogurt, ferment your milk. If you don't have access to raw milk, you can try raw cheese, which is aged for 60 days. You can find raw milk near you at realmilk.com. No affiliation, just throwing it out so you guys know where to find that. But how fascinating that milk contains beneficial things for humans, probably contributing to society, certainly has an association with lower rates of childhood obesity, and that raw milk might be protective because of undenatured whey protein rather than probiotic components of the milk, which actually argues against the pasteurization of milk in general. Maybe don't drink pasteurized milk if you have autoimmune conditions. That's an interesting thing to discover. So all of this is theoretical. What studies do we have on dietary interventions and weight loss? Are there any studies with an animal-based diet? Like I said, there's no formal studies with an animal-based diet, but there are studies with diets that look pretty darn similar. There are studies with Paleolithic diets that I'll show you in a moment that are ad lib, which I think is the most valid type of study to be looking at with weight loss because it recreates what happens in the normal world. And there are studies with something that looks a lot like an animal-based diet in Aborigines, but it is calorie restricted. And there's a very interesting study in Aborigines looking at something that is essentially an animal-based diet with no vegetables, and it is a calorie-restricted trial. So this one is fascinating to me. Marked improvement in carbohydrate and lipid metabolism in diabetic Australian Aborigines after temporary reversion to a traditional lifestyle. The concept is amazing, they say. In conclusion, major metabolic abnormalities of type 2 diabetes either greatly improved or completely normalized in this group of Aborigines by relatively short reversal of the urbanization process. At least three factors known to improve insulin sensitivity, weight loss, low-fat diet, and increased physical activity were operating in the study would have contributed to the metabolic changes observed. If you look at what they ate beef, kangaroo, turtle, bream, yams, honey, or fish, birds, kangaroo, crocodile, or kangaroo, freshwater fish, yams, honey, figs, birds, crocodile, turtle, and yabbies, which are like crawfish. So the only thing on here that isn't technically animal-based are the yams, which are tubers, but essentially these people are eating honey and figs and meat as part of their diet and seeing marked improvements in diabetes. Again, these are pretty low-calorie dietary estimates. I have trouble believing that they're actually this low, but perhaps their basal metabolic rate was so low that this was all they needed. I believe this study was actually ad libitum, meaning they could eat as much as they wanted to, and they selected very low-calorie diets. I don't know if that's because there were only limited resources available or because they were satiated. Either way, it's still interesting that this is ad lib and not a controlled hypocaloric study, and that when they returned to their aboriginal non-urbanized lifestyle, a lot of things improved. Imagine that. There is a controlled ad libitum study with a Paleolithic diet that I think is fascinating, published in Lipids and Health in 2014. Favorable effects of consuming a Paleolithic diet on characteristics of the metabolic syndrome. This is a randomized controlled pilot study. The most interesting part of this was that the Paleolithic diet compared to the reference, despite efforts to keep body weight stable, weight decreased in the Paleolithic group compared to the reference range. The P was 0.012. However, favorable effects remained after post-hoc adjustments for this unintended weight loss. No changes were observed for intestinal permeability, inflammation, or salivary control. We conclude that consuming a Paleolithic diet for 2 weeks improved several cardiovascular risk factors compared with a healthy reference diet in subjects with the metabolic syndrome. What's so interesting for me is that in this study, when people were allowed to eat as much as they wanted, not put in calorie prison, they lost weight on a Paleolithic diet. Despite efforts to maintain body weight, they lost weight. That is what I'm talking about. And this is a diet that has vegetables, it has fruit, it has nuts and seeds, and it has meat. Now, not a huge fan of nuts and seeds. I've talked about it in the past. Not a huge fan of vegetables, but it proves a point that when you remove processed foods, there weren't a lot of seed oils in this study, there weren't a lot of processed grains or processed sugars. If you improve the quality of your diet, and if you do that with a paleo diet, I'm super happy for you. I think getting rid of the vegetables would be even better. But if you do that with a paleolithic diet or an animal-based diet of organs, meat, fruit, honey, and raw dairy, I think you will lose weight without even trying. And that's what this study points to. Pretty cool. There are other trials with paleolithic diets. This one is from 2016. Cardiovascular metabolic effects, dietary composition of ad lib paleo versus Australian guide to health eating diets, 4-week randomized trial. Again, ad lib, significantly greater weight loss occurred in the paleolithic group rather than the Australian guide to healthy eating diets. In this randomized trial, paleolithic diet induced greater changes in body composition over the short-term intervention, larger studies recommended, et cetera, et cetera. But again, ad lib study, with a meat-focused diet that also included things like nuts and seeds and vegetables and fruit, led to increased weight loss relative to the control diet, which is an Australian guide to healthy eating diet. Satiety is king. Don't go to Shawshank calorie prison, guys. Here's yet another interesting graphic from a study titled Metabolic and Physiologic Improvements from Consuming a Paleolithic Hunter-Gatherer Type Diet. You can see here that in this study, that fasting insulin decreased from 69 plus or minus 63 to 21 plus or minus 7. The p-value was 0.07. Didn't quite reach statistical significance at 0.05 for a p-value, but pretty darn close at 0.07. What other types of diets work for weight loss? Well, as I said earlier, I'm most interested in diets and dietary trials that are ad lib. You can feed someone anything you want and restrict their calories, and they will lose weight. I don't think they will have the same nutrient adequacy. I don't think they'll have the same hormonal profiles. I don't think they'll have the same success with the diet long-term or ease of weight loss, but you can feed someone a calorie-restricted diet of pure potatoes, pure Twinkies, pure Pop-Tarts, whatever you want, and they will lose weight. So calorie-restricted diets are not terribly interesting for me in terms of a weight loss literature. There is some interesting literature on Mediterranean diets and Mediterranean diet adherence, suggesting that these do improve weight loss and there is good adherence with these diets. An interesting feature of a Mediterranean diet that not many people are aware of is that a Mediterranean diet focuses on olive oil, not my favorite fat. I think people would do better with tallow or butter, higher in stearic acid and other odd-chain fatty acids, higher in phytanic acids, but it cuts out the seed oils. Not many people understand that one of the real possibilities for the improvements in cardiovascular outcomes with a Mediterranean diet is the removal of seed oils from the diet. It's a low seed oil diet, and you can see improvements in health outcomes like weight, compliance, et cetera. I think a lot of diets that limit seed oils would have the same improvements. So here's one trial exploring the relationship between the Mediterranean diet and weight loss maintenance, the MedWeight study. They say higher adherence to the Mediterranean diet was associated with twofold increase likelihood of weight loss maintenance. Of course, if you stick to a diet that is higher quality, you're likely going to lose more weight. Systemic review of the Mediterranean diet for long-term weight loss. Mediterranean diet results in similar weight loss and cardiovascular risk factor level reduction as comparator diets in overweight and obese individuals trying to lose weight. So in head-to-head trials, it looked about the same as other types of diets. It depends whether these are hypocaloric, isocaloric, or ad lib, but there is some data with the Mediterranean diet, though I think that the main improvements with this diet are the removal of seed oils. I don't think there's any magic to olive oil or whole grains. I know many of you will ask about low-carb diets, and I think that low-carb diets do work, but I don't think they're necessary to lose weight. I think you can lose weight, like the trials on a Paleolithic diet illustrate, without restricting your carbohydrates to very low levels. And I think you can lose weight ad libitum, eating as much as you want, according to those two paleo ad lib trials, unintentionally when you improve the quality of your food. I do not think you need to limit carbohydrates. Carbohydrate restriction does work for some people by limiting hunger. Looks like long-term ketosis lowers ghrelin. But as I've talked about recently on multiple podcasts, had a friendly debate with Thomas DeLauer, talked about why I stopped doing keto a few years ago. There are many negative side effects associated with not having carbohydrates in your diet. And on the flip side, there are many positives to having carbohydrates in your diet. I choose to get those carbohydrates from fruit and honey, and perhaps I get some carbohydrates from lactose in raw milk as well. But there's an interesting trial here that I wanted to talk about. Dietary carbohydrate restriction improved metabolic syndrome independent of weight loss. There actually wasn't a whole lot of weight loss in this 4-week trial, but I want to point out one thing. In this trial, in the low carbohydrate groups, despite containing 2.5 more times saturated fat than the high carbohydrate diet, a low carbohydrate diet decreased plasma total saturated fat and plasma palmitoleate and increased arachidonate. So many times people get confused about saturated fat and think that eating more saturated fat will lead to higher levels of saturated fat or palmitoleic acid in the blood. These are associated with insulin resistance. These are mediators released by your fat cells to signal to the periphery that your muscles should become insulin resistant. But as demonstrated in this trial and many others, eating saturated fat improves insulin resistance, as they demonstrated in this study, in a low carbohydrate context, and that lowers saturated fat and that lowers plasma palmitoleic acid. So eating saturated fat, eating animal fats will not raise saturated fat or palmitoleic acid in your bloodstream. That is a misconception and something to be very careful of when you are listening to other research. So where does this leave us? When we are thinking about weight loss, my exhortation to you is do not go to Shawshank calorie-restricted prison. That is not the way to lose weight long-term in a healthful manner. Testosterone will go down, your estrogen will go down, your progesterone will go down. I think that your thyroid hormone will tank as well. You must improve your dietary quality to lose weight. And I think that when you do that, weight loss will be much easier. It's never easy to make a dietary change, but I believe weight loss will be much easier when you change and improve your dietary quality. What does that look like? It means correcting your westernized dietary pattern. Where do you start? Getting rid of seed oils. I talked about seed oils and anandamide and 2-AG, potentially triggering brain mechanisms that make you hungrier. I talked about omega-6 fatty acids in maternal plasma and childhood obesity. I talk about mechanisms by which kids and babies in utero may develop more adipocytes from excess seed oils. I also have talked about the importance of nutrients on the flip side to create satiety. Where do you get nutrients from? Whole foods. They can be plant or animal origin. I believe the best way to construct a diet is to focus on the animal foods. Get organs, either fresh or desiccated, like we make at Hardened Soil. Get meat, preferably from a grass-fed, grass-finished source. Get fruit. I believe that's the least toxic plant food because it wants to get eaten. Plants don't want you to eat leaves and stems and roots and seeds. They're full of defense chemicals. And honey doesn't seem to have defense chemicals. I also like raw dairy. I showed data for raw dairy and decreased allergy, eczema, and allergic disease in children in both suburban and rural settings. And I actually talked about mechanisms by which raw milk may be beneficial for humans. I continue to believe that an animal-based diet is the optimal diet for humans. Ultimately, I don't care what you eat. If you lose weight, you feel better, you look better, and you're thriving. As I've said time and time again, if you're thriving, don't change anything about your diet. If you're watching a podcast about weight loss, maybe you want to lose weight and you're not thriving. And at that point, you probably should question and reconsider your nutritional paradigms so that you can continue to grow and become curious and learn and challenge what you've held in your brain. But there's no evidence that red meat leads to weight gain. There's no evidence that dairy is problematic for humans. At least raw dairy, pasteurized dairy may be problematic for some humans, but some studies associate it with beneficial outcomes. Getting rid of those seed oils, processed grains, and processed sugars, changing the quality of your diet, there will be nothing that you can do that will be better for your weight loss than that. And that includes exercise. Yes, exercise is important, but I believe that if you change the quality of your diet, you will feel better. You will have more energy and you will want to exercise. You will want to get up and move. It doesn't have to be complex. I think that humans need to move, but the way you move doesn't have to be crazy. It doesn't have to be CrossFit. It can be slight weight training. Some load-bearing activity to have lean muscle mass is critical for humans, but even getting out in the sun and moving a little bit is probably going to be a beneficial thing for you. It doesn't have to be intense exercise. And I do not believe that your sustained healthy weight loss will hinge on you exercising like a madman or a madwoman. In fact, that can be a negative thing. So hopefully this helps give you a framework for how to lose weight. At Heart and Soil, we have free health coaches. You can always email us, radicalhealth@heartandsoil.co. They will walk you through how to lose weight, how to construct an animal-based diet. We just finished animal-based 30 at Heart and Soil in August. We'll do another one in probably November. Stay tuned for that. So hope this is helpful for you guys. See you next week.